the really curious thing about working and being with John is that we sometimes would see each other and sit down, and suddenly the wordplay started going between us. And he was always like really creative and came up with different words and expressions to describe something. And it was just a great deal of pleasure working with him. And one of the things that we did was that there would be a request for a public service announcement to be made at KYUK. And so we would work out a script so that both of us would record this together. He would give the information for the public service announcement in Yupik, and we would be talking back and forth as if we were, in a sense, just general conversation, and I would respond in English. But we'd also play a few games that way, that sometimes he would purposely mispronounce a Yupik word, and then I would correct his pronunciation of that Yupik word. Of course, I couldn't speak Yupik at all. It was all very much planned that way. And part of the fun of working with KYUK at that time was that we really could, instead of mimicking how AM, FM radio conducts themselves in a very, and sometimes somewhat formal way, we were kind of really interested in kind of contriving a manner of speaking and doing things that seemed to be very localized and more specific to people that live there.
You weren't trying to imitate what is known as the sound of public radio. You were just trying to create something authentic to the area.
That's right. Yeah. And that was the real pleasure of working there. And of course, I worked there for just 2 years as a means of getting kind of grounded in the community, and then only dealt with KYUK in a voluntary reading news for the 10 years after.
And then for that 10 years, what was your interaction with John? How did you work together?
You know, John was one of these people that, and I've really thought about this, he would kind of come in and out of our lives. Would be intensely involved with him for a few weeks or at times. But then there were other times where I was not in contact with him for a few weeks or so. He was really kind of in and out. Of course, as we all knew, that he'd had a drinking problem, and at least we just were not in contact during that period.
Yeah, everyone I've spoken with has talked about, you know, how John would, he would just go away, and then he would come back to the station. Do you remember how he was received when he would return back to the station?
Anytime John kind of walked into the room and such, always there was this really kind of a sparky response and comments, and there was this just wonderful feeling of when he would enter the room and everybody would be laughing and having a lot of fun.
I think John was just such a special person that, as Jim said, he could walk into a room and just light things up. The other thing about him was, because he was so bright and so funny, that he went through a number of periods in his life when he sort of collected a family around himself. Well, I'm not even sure he had anything to do with it, but people just wanted to be in that light that John created. And everybody knew that he did have drinking problems, and many of us, myself included, tried to help him with that. But once you'd sort of accepted that John was John, it was worth waiting those weeks to see him again and giving him the autonomy that he needed and the support that he needed to do his creative work. He was really, really creative, and people loved him. What I remember about the early days is being at the little house, the little red house on the slough where Maggie and Adolph lived, and you know, he'd be there, and we'd have tea and Maggie would tell her stories. And just seeing the three of them together was really wonderful. His relationship with his grandmother was really deep. And Maggie was also an incredible person. And I just feel honored to have been in the room with the two of them while she was still alive.
And this is Adolf Lind and Maggie Lind, who lived across the slough, and they served as grandparents to him. He initially was born to a family in a village that no longer exists. I think it's called Chuckwaktalik or Chuckfoktalik, that is much further west, and was adopted. And that's how he ended up in Bethel.
Yeah, Elsie told me that when she went to pick him up, he was an infant. And when she went to pick him up, she said he was just skin and bones. And we're all very grateful that he survived those first few months because he was such a wonderful guy. Elsie was Maggie Lynn's daughter, and she adopted John when he was an infant. But eventually, John ended up pretty much living with his grandparents. But Elsie was around.
Whenever John's storytelling is mentioned, Maggie Lind is also mentioned, saying that he learned the stories and the craft of storytelling from her. You got to observe them interacting. Did you see similarities in the way John told stories with the way Maggie Lind told stories?
I would say definitely yes. You know, it was very clear that's where all of his storytelling came from. When he was there with Maggie and Adolf, usually Maggie was talking. You know, Maggie was doing the storytelling and he was listening because that's, I'm sure, what he did with Maggie. And then it was interesting because Adolf hardly ever talked. And then after Maggie died, Adolf suddenly started telling stories of a very different kind.
Right. I should mention that Maggie sang and danced, drummed. And the curious thing is that the Moravian church at the time was pretty determined to try to, in a sense, stop a lot of drumming and singing and dancing. And even though she attended the Moravian church, she defied them and continued dancing and drumming.
I don't want to contrive anything, but you saying that makes me think of John. Like, you tell him not to do something, he might listen to you, but he's just going to do what he wants.
Yeah, pretty much so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Jim, I've heard people mention the back and forth that you and John would have. Bev Hoffman was telling me that people would listen, herself included, and just crack up at the back and forth between you and John. Will you describe kind of that dynamic between the two of you?
When we did that over the air, we did that. I mean, it was a complete scripted thing. And so that, you know, it was not quite the same thing as the kind of the general back and forth conversations that we had. But we really tried to make those kinds of things with the radio just a lot of fun and fun for people to listen to. Because, of course, radio and television was really unique out there and being received by people in some of the villages for the first time.
But I think what Bev was talking about was just the general sitting around and talking. And both Jim and John just really enjoyed having a lot of fun with language. And if they couldn't think of the right word for what they were trying to express, they made one up. And John was just brilliant at taking two words and combining them together. And so you never knew what they were going to say next. It was just a delight to listen to them.
Both of you seemed to arrive when radio, when KYUK was starting, which brought radio to the area, or public radio at least, to the area. Jim, I'm curious about how you said, you know, you wanted to stay on the radio, on the TV, so that people would maintain that awareness of you. So when you dropped into a village, you weren't a total stranger. Will you speak about the reach that KYUK had, the connection it had to the villages?
At the time when I arrived, it did not extend very, very far out of Bethel. In fact, I worked a little bit, and I flew with Don Porter, who had been contracted to put in translator units. And the question always was what hills that these things could be placed so that the signal could be then carried up to the Yukon in one case, and then further down the Kuskokwim. And there was one time when it was at the village of Tunatuliak, which is roughly 50, 60 air miles downriver from Bethel. And a translator system had been put in, and it was decided that a camera person and I should fly down to Tunatuliak and do a story about their receiving news that night for the first time. So we flew down in the afternoon and actually crashed on their runway, plane flipped over. But then we were picked up, flown, not hurt, flown back to Bethel, ran back with the tapes of the video that we did about crashing. And so their first news was about a plane crash in their village.
Let me answer your question in a different way. It was a very exciting time in the whole state at that time, but particularly in the bush. The Land Claim Settlement Act had gone through, and there was, you know, money flowing out into the regions. And I think the KYUK was really instrumental in helping people understand what was going on, and also, to a great extent, developing a regional identity. I think that people were very identified with their villages and with sort of associated villages. But I don't know. I think KYK was really, really instrumental in sort of bringing people together. And it was at a point where it was really important for people to advocate for themselves. And I don't know that that would have happened without people being really informed about what was going on, even nationally. One of the projects that Jim did, and I guess I was somewhat involved in it, was he worked a lot with Nunam Klutsti. And when it was time to pass the Magnuson Act, he did a whole booklet on what subsistence was like, and particularly around the herring fishing. And then the Magnuson Act passed, which was really important for local fishermen. But I just don't know that people would have gotten involved to the extent that they needed to be if it hadn't been for KYUK.
What are the contributions that you see John having given to public media?
I'm sure that he will be remembered by people in the whole Delta for a long time because of his creativity and his humor.
And I think he was the voice of the Delta in many ways for people who did not live there.
Yeah, I really think that probably throughout the Delta, that probably there is this feeling that when they heard John's voice, that there is really a kind of a respect for...
Well, his knowledge.
His knowledge, yeah. And also kind of the cultural voice in some ways that he would use or that would be thought of.
And that was his inheritance, you know. Maggie was seen the same way, and I have a wonderful recording of her telling the story about how the crane got blue eyes. And yeah, she was seen that way, and so in a way, you know, that legacy was just passed down to John.
Well, thank you both so much for taking time, and I'm glad that this all worked out.
Well, thank you. It was really fun. It's fun thinking about John.